when the early followers of Jesus were looking for language to describe him, for words to describe what he meant to them, they often looked back into the book of the prophet Isaiah. And there they found some amazing language that describes the leader whom God will send to God's people. We hear this morning from Isaiah chapter 11. Listen, will you, for the word of God. A shoot will grow up from the stump of Jesse. A branch will sprout from his roots. And the Lord's Spirit will rest upon him, a spirit of wisdom and understanding, a spirit of planning and strength, a spirit of knowledge and also the fear of God. He will delight in fearing the Lord. He won't judge others by appearances, nor decide by hearsay. He will judge the needy with righteousness and decide with equity for those who suffer in the land. He will strike the violent with the rod of his mouth. By the breath of his lips, he will kill the wicked. Righteousness will be a belt around his hips and faithfulness a belt around his waist. And the wolf will live with the lamb. The leopard will lie down with the young goat. The calf and the young lion will feed together, and a little child will lead them. The cow and the bear, they will graze together. Their young will lie down next to each other. And the lion will eat straw like the ox, and a nursing child will play over the snake's hole. Toddlers will reach right over the serpent's den, and they won't harm or destroy on all of my holy mountain, says God. The earth will surely be filled with the knowledge of the Lord, just like the water covers the sea. This is the word of God for the people of God.
Thanks be to God.
Isaiah says that the Lord's Spirit will rest upon a wonderful counselor. A spirit of wisdom and understanding will be in that counselor, a spirit of planning and strength, a spirit of knowledge and fear of the Lord. This counselor will create such a beautiful order among us that natural enemies will trust each other. A wonderful counselor, Old Testament scholar Walter Brueggemann says, is a visionary leader, one with the insight into our human nature, to be able to see how the systems that we live in imprison us. A wonderful counselor will have the imagination to see beyond the way things have always been done and create among us a new way of life. Our current life, exposed over these last few months, is broken in painful ways. We could use a wonderful counselor right about now to diagnose what ails us and heal what feels broken. Over these last 50 years in our country, we are engaged in a great struggle, and it's a struggle that brings people out of the shadows and into the light. This thing we've come to call the civil rights movement recognized the personhood of all of God's children and has sought equal protection under the law, ending discrimination based on the color of our skin. The women's rights movement has fought the patriarchy that has forever made women's decisions subject to men's. It has sought to give women their freedom over their careers and their lives and our bodies. Our Latino and Latina brothers and sisters have been working for visibility and respect. People who came here seeking a better way of life, they worked hard. They simply want basic protections for their work and their wages and their safety of themselves and their families. And the LGBTQ community has fought hard over these last 50 years to fight against the stigma of non-heteronormative sexuality, boldly asserting that every person should be able to marry or not and simply live as full and free beings without fear of discrimination or physical or emotional harm. And I'd be remiss if I didn't add to this list of our collective struggles the struggle for ecological justice. For we are also in a struggle to see that the earth itself is a subject worthy of honoring, not an object to be used and discarded. Now, these movements, while they all involve different groups of people, are very much part of the same human awakening. We are awakening to the right of every one of God's children to live freely and fully on this earth, to be free from harm, to keep what's ours and be able to pass it to our children, to work the land, to go to school, to get a job and make a home in the community where we choose, to use our gifts for the sake of the common good. None of these things is radical, right? None of it's radical unless you consider radical the idea that all people are created equal, that we're endowed by our Creator with inalienable rights, that among these are life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness. This is our birthright. And it's been our national project for 50 or more years. But you know that something else has been happening during the same time. Major changes in the way we organize our economic life. Changes that have sent life-giving, community-sustaining jobs from towns all over our country to towns in Mexico and India and China. The Americans who have lost the most economically during the last 40 years are white men. And so in towns in every state in this country, they have watched communities decline. They have watched as debts have grown, marriages fall apart, children move away, drugs move in, hope disappears. Even as Americans have been coming out of the shadows, others have been slipping into them. We are broken in some very painful ways. Those of us who have struggled to be seen and recognized as human beings are just now getting somewhere. And we're not where we want to be, but we're getting somewhere. And yet, at the same time, there's a whole group of folks who have come to see that these basic gains in the human rights of others have somehow come at their expense. It feels like an impasse. Like, if I rise, then you must recede. If I'm allowed to become me, does it mean that you are not allowed to become you? Now, most of us in this place are loath to admit it. But if we ever did remedy these historic injustices in our country, many of us would end up losing ground ourselves. The truth is that a lot of us, including myself, benefit from some form of inequality. If you live in a nice neighborhood like I do in the city of Decatur, you benefit from inequality. Now, imagine this, if suddenly the DeKalb County schools were to get markedly better, if suddenly the government of DeKalb County were to function smoothly, if suddenly South DeKalb became a prosperous and booming community, then the value of my house would decline in relation. The value of my home, that's the single greatest asset that we have, would lose value. Put another way, if South DeKalb is a nightmare, I benefit. About a year ago, I was up at Montreat at a conference up in the hills of North Carolina, and they invited a bunch of folks to come and speak, and one of them was a columnist for the New York Times named Charles Blow. He put it succinctly. Now, he was talking about Ferguson, Missouri, but he was also talking about Atlanta and every single other community in our nation when he said, Your property values depend on that black kid lying face down in the street on the other side of town. And he was talking to me, and maybe you. If the economy privileges urban centers over rural areas, you benefit. If you're a man making a dollar for the 78 cents that a woman makes, you benefit. If the police haven't singled you out because of something about your appearance, you benefit. If you've never been the target of slurs or harassment, you benefit. Even if you didn't ask for it or don't like it, the nature of inequality is that it benefits those who are on the top. This is a harsh reality, and it has been brought to the fore of our public consciousness. It's rough. It's a hard truth to hold. And some of the conflict we feel in the world around us is a function of us trying to deal with this hard truth. But anyone who sees the image of God etched on every other human being's face should resist a system that keeps an unequal peace. Can I be me and also empower you to be you, is the question we would ask. It's not a new struggle, right? It's not new to our generation. People who are in positions of power always get to establish the terms of the peace. And in most places, in most cultures, in most times, people in power establish peace at the cost of someone else's freedom. So what does Jesus have to say to us? What can we say about Jesus, this quirky man with his unorthodox power? Jesus lived in a world that was not entirely dissimilar to ours. He lived in a place called Galilee. You may have heard of it. It was a Jewish colony of the Roman Empire. Roman rule was known widely as the Pax Romana, the Peace of Rome. The Romans replaced all of the constant warring that had taken place in local areas with their own version of peace. They built roads and trade networks. Their peace enriched people who had the title of citizen, who owned land and resources and were protected by the laws. That peace was kept by the greatest army the world had ever seen, who indiscriminately tortured and killed and humiliated those who would threaten the peace. Isn't it interesting? I think it's interesting that God, the same God who heard the cries of God's beloved people when they were enslaved in Egypt, the same God decided to send a child into the heart of the Roman Empire. And that child would grow up and he would read his Bible and marinate in these stories and learn its wisdom. And that child would grow up and become a wonderful counselor. Jesus, with a spirit of wisdom and understanding, a spirit of planning and strength, a spirit of knowledge and fear of the Lord, Jesus brings peace. Now remember, no weapons, no armed guards, Jesus had no power to extort, no power to seize people's property, no legal background at all. All Jesus had to make peace were his hands, his words, and his thoughts. And so he brought those three things to the fishermen along the shore of the Sea of Galilee who lived in grinding poverty and perpetual indebtedness. He taught those men and those women about the shape of the human life. He told them, you come from God and you return to God. So orient your whole life to God. Don't mind the emperor. Pay attention to God. He chastised them for thinking that money was somehow significant. Don't be foolish, he said. There is one thing that is important in life, and it's love. How you give and how you receive love is how God measures a life. He didn't just say this to them. He became one with them. He walked with them and became their friend and their teacher. He became one with those who were struggling. To those the world demeaned, he lifted. To those the world bruised, he healed. Anyone hungry in their stomach for food, he fed. And if they were hungry in their stomach for justice, he fed them too. And as he broke bread with women and men, he made them into the most wonderful and powerful thing in the whole world. He made them into a community. A community shaped by hospitality and generosity and care for each other. Jesus gave to those women and men the capacity to see and to know that if you help me become me, and if I help you become you, God makes us better and stronger together. That is peace. And it is a gift from God through Jesus. And it's every bit as possible now as it has ever been. But we get deceived about peace. We get deceived. We think, as the poet Robert Pinsky indicates in the Call to Reconciliation from this morning, we get deceived that peace is the absence of conflict, that if everyone will just pipe down and be quiet, then that's peace. That's not peace. We also get deceived into thinking that peace is something that we do for ourselves. Now, I like the good yoga class and a silent meditation retreat as much as anyone, right? But if someone is marketing you peace as something you do for yourself, you are being deceived. God's peace is a relationship between two things. Peace happens between things. So how do you seek peace? How do you make peace? Well, first, seek out the way of Jesus. Right? Every day in Advent, do me a favor and open the Gospels and read a section, right? Get familiar with these books again. Get familiar with the way of Jesus in the world. See how he loves. See who he loves. And walk in those footsteps. And then deepen the peace in your own relationships. In each of your relationships, ask some questions. Look around at the people next to you or the people behind you, or think about your neighbors or your coworkers, your family members. Ask, am I seeking the freedom of this other person in the context of this relationship? Am I seeking their freedom? Are we free to be and become in each other's presence? If not, there is work to be done in that relationship. For peace to emerge in our relationships, there must be this thing we call trust. You must be able to tell the truth and hear the truth. Trust grows from equal portions of honesty and humility. If trust is not there, it will not come overnight. It must be planted in between you and another person and grown from a seed, nurtured and allowed to flourish over time. But if the soil of trust, if that deep, rich, dark earth, that soil of trust is sustained, eventually there will be love. Love is when you accept me for me, and I accept you for you, and you encourage me to become more than I am, and I encourage you to be more than you are. That is love, and freedom, and trust, and love between two people. There is community, and there is peace. That is the new social order of God's beloved community, and it is your calling. It is your calling. You who would follow Jesus are called, even and especially in this time of pain and conflict, to seek peace. So is there someone that you know that you need to sit down with because you have not been honest, nor have you been humble enough with each other? Go and spend some time with them this week. Or maybe there is some aspect of your life that is dependent on the systems and structures of inequality, that unjust peace, and you have abided by it too long. How will you alter the course of your life to liberate yourself from that unjust peace and discover something deeper? That's hard, but it's our calling. Or maybe the peaceful relationship that you are called to cultivate in the coming days is with your own self. Have you made peace with your own life, with who you are in the eyes of God? Can you honestly acknowledge your flaws with grace in such a way that you stop lashing out against the things in others that you have not yet accepted about yourself? Peace is not only our calling, it is our destiny. It is this constant process of interior awakening to the possibility of our mutual liberation. And it is an interior awakening that unfolds into an exterior journey to defy and rework the systems and structures that perpetuate the unjust peace. So, what do you think? Is it possible? Is peace possible? Is it possible for you to live in peace? The cynic says, no. The cynic says nature is red in tooth and claw. We'll never arise above that person Pinsky describes in the cage throwing his own feces. Jesus' way of life, some say, is so implausible. It's so unnatural. It's almost like the lion and the lamb laying down, dwelling in each other's presence. Friends, in every generation, people have hungered for the power of God to come and fix what's broken, to replace the unholy peace to which we have wearily resigned ourselves with that greater peace that is our birthright and the birthright of the whole creation. Is it possible for us to learn freedom, to learn trust, and to learn how to love each other? Can we learn what makes for peace so that there will be no more harming on all of God's holy mountain and the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the Lord, just like the water covers the sea? It's the dreamers.
and the visionaries and the ones who harbor hope that see this and believe that God can do it. So we cry out to God and we say, if only God will hear us like God did so long ago. If only God will send us the one who can order our steps, who can shape our lives both inside and out. If only God will send us a balm for the ways that we hurt and a cure for the ways that we hurt each other. If only God will send to us a wonderful counselor.